did a bit of graduate studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and then she moved to British Columbia, where she carried on some research in palynology and forest ecology. She also studied local flora in Northwest British Columbia, where she taught biology lab at Northwest Community College in Paris for 6 years. And while she was in Paris, she offered workshops in edible plants and mushrooms. I think she's somebody we really need to get to know. In 1985, she began conducting research in ethnobotany with the Gitan and Lipsuritan. That might be close. First Nations. And in 1991, she returned to university to complete her studies, and she earned her MA and PhD at the University of Alberta. After her PhD, she stayed on as a postdoctoral fellow, and then she began a sustained research program in comparative ethnoecology with the First Nations in BC, Yukon, and Northwest Territories. Since 2000, she has been teaching anthropology with Athabasca University, and she's in the Center for Work and Community Studies and in the MEES program. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks to audiences present and elsewhere in cyberspace. So the title of my talk today is Of Rice Root, Crab Apples, and Huckleberries, Evidence for Environmental Management by First Nations in Northwest British Columbia. And I have to confess, I'm speaking in a fourth species. I'll also talk about beaked hazelnut today. So there's been a recent focus on recognizing environmental management among Western peoples and the diversity of sustainable ways of making a living in a wide-ranging environment around the globe. I just got back from the ethnobiology meeting in Berkeley, where there was a day-long symposium on Aboriginal environmental management in British Columbia. And my recently finished MA student, Ken Downs, and I co-presented part of our research on two of the species discussed in this talk, rice root lily and Pacific crabapple. Our presentation there dovetailed nicely with a number of other presentations on environmental management in different areas of British Columbia and of different species. And the whole symposium follows on the recently published volume edited by Doug Dewar and Nancy Turner entitled Keeping It Living, Traditions of Plant Use and Cultivation on the Northwest Coast of North America. And for those of you who are an anthropologist, I remind you briefly that most First Nations of Canada are not considered cultivators. So this is challenging sort of received wisdom about people that have been classified as hunter-gatherers in terms of the nature and intensity of their interaction with their landscapes. So the recognition and significance of the significance and importance of indigenous environmental management in Northwestern North America was very late in coming because it didn't match well with the neat square fields and fenced pastures of Eastern North America and Europe. It didn't match our concept of an agricultural landscape. And this lack of appreciation of indigenous use and management of much of the land base in British Columbia provided the rationale for alienation of the bulk of indigenous territories in the process of colonization, as European colonists could only recognize gardens, green fields, hay fields, nice neat orchards and pastures as occupied and managed land. Nancy Turner and Sandy Peacock have described the difficulty with recognizing indigenous management and cultivation in British Columbia as the perennial paradox, because unlike European agriculture based heavily in annual grains and vegetable crops, food plants of Aboriginal British Columbia were predominantly from perennial trees, shrubs, and herbs, which require quite different systems of management, and were embedded in very distinct social and property systems from those familiar to Europeans. Similar difficulties, I would add, have attended the recognition of the sustainability and workability of Swidden or slash of their agricultural systems in the tropics, and of the pervasive influence of local peoples upon apparently pristine environments around the globe. So in a region like Northwest British Columbia, long indigenous occupants and management of landscape has had pervasive ecological effects which are now coming to be recognized. And in such an environment, figuring out what is natural and what's anthropogenic in terms of the traces of Aboriginal management at this remove after the one approach to exploring the influence of First Nations on the landscape and regional ecology is through analysis of the distribution of key plants, which are known to be ethnobotanically important in relation to known travel sites, villages, and other cultural features. My former student, Ken Downs, and I hypothesized that the distribution of several key plants in the Skeena region of Northwest British Columbia is in fact anthropogenic, especially as you move away from the apparent natural centers of distribution toward more marginal sites. So I'm going to look today at detailed evidence for the management of four species and some associated environments in Northwest BC based on my own work and that of two former students, Ken Downs from Athabasca and Scott Tressler, who finished a master's at the University of British Columbia in 2002. So our area of interest comprises the homelands of Tsimshian, Gitxsan, Nisga, Haifa, and the Tsilhqot'in people. And I've also made observations in the past of plant distributions in Haida Gwaii. And I'll include a bit of information about the Tlingit from Southeast Alaska. For this talk, I want to focus on four plants, rice root lily, Pacific crab apple, black huckleberry, and beet hazelnut, which were all important food plants within their range, and Pacific crab apples and black huckleberries continue to be prized by First Nations people. And in fact, black huckleberries are relished by everybody who's ever eaten them. So Ken and I have examined localities of these plants and characterized the sites ecologically and in relation to historic and more ancient First Nations sites, trails, and trails in the region, combining ethnographic approaches, interviews, and so on, and archival work with vegetation ecology and biogeography. Rice root lily and Pacific crab apple have extensive ranges on the northwest coast, but extend inland only in certain areas, like along the Skeena drainage, a major trading and travel corridor connecting coastal and interior environments. While black huckleberry and beet hazelnut have more interior distributions and their coastward localities appear to be closely associated with habitation sites. So what do these guys look like? This is rice root lily, city plant. Chocolate, it's a fertile area, has bell-shaped chocolate flowers, and it has these interesting bulbs with little tiny bulblets that look like rice, hence its name. Rice root lily bulbs and bulblets were a widely used root vegetable on the northern northwest coast and were especially important north of the range of another more widely known lily with edible bulbs, camas. The northern environment of the northwest coast offered a relatively limited array of carbohydrate foods to complement the abundant fish, shellfish, and wild meat. So only a few types of root vegetables, various berry species, and the edible inner bark of several species of trees comprise the available sources of carbohydrates. After the introduction of potatoes, the use of this plant, rice root lily, which is also an important source of folic acid, declined, and it's no longer important in regional diet cuisine. And this is the range of rice root lily in our region, and you can see that sort of little ponytail sticking out to the east, which is its distribution along the Skeena River. And these are sites that Ken and I documented for rice root in the region. You can see the sites that are marked with black dots are places that we have actually visited and determined that rice root was there. And the sites with pink dots are places yet to be collected that we hope to get specimens from this coming spring. And they were described to us by local First Nations collaborators. Told us there's rice root here, and there's rice root here, and there's rice root here, and we need to go and find it.
Leslie?
Yes?
Maureen has a question. She wants to know whether distribution is evidence for cultivation.
We'll be describing that.
Okay.
We're getting there.
Okay.
All of the local languages have names for rice root, which is used as a food by all the groups. The Gixan name means bitter, not, while the Tsimshian name suggests that the original name for rice root, Niyok, was transferred to domestic rice, leaving the wild plant described as Niyogum Get, man's rice. So it's common on the coast, where it grows in the sort of narrow band of non-forested vegetation between the high tide mark and the dense forest. And it's associated there both with camps and former camps and middens, and in areas which were apparently not habitation sites. Upriver, in contrast, localities for rice root seem to be focused in areas subject to human activity, such as along historic trails, in clearings maintained in an open state by burning, and in village areas. And the plants that you see on the right were growing in a burned area along a former major regional trail and wagon road. And here you can see the relatively open area that where they were growing created by periodic landscape burning. If you don't burn those bottom land sites, they grow to very dense and impenetrable shrub communities and eventually to cottonwood forest or whatever. They don't stay in a meadow state unless you maintain them. And I discovered the plants here in May in 1988. In a place near where I used to pick fiddleheads. And I had been observing that those areas were maintained by people from Givenchy, you know, to maintain pasture. And in some other areas, they also burned along the bottomlands for sites for potato gardens. In the 18 years since this photograph was taken, regrowth has occurred in much of the site, though I was able to recognize the cleared area shown in this photo last summer, after hours of thrashing through brush to find it. Well, as part of his MACE project research, Ken Downs investigated the vegetation of several known historic and archaeological Tsimshian habitation sites near Terrace, BC, beginning with his ethnobiology class and then focusing on this in his project research. So this research and his tantalizing results, in fact, led to our present collaborative research project. Ken found rice root at Calum Canyon, a Tsimshian area of long historic habitation here in Terrace, BC, about 90 kilometers from the Stina estuary, in an area he calls the garden site. And here you can see that this persistent opening where Sherry Ronson is standing is just in the sunny spot behind that is his left-hand photo? Yes. Where Jim McDonald is standing and a young lady whose name I don't know is photographing house pit remains. So there were several house pit depressions from pre-contact Tsimshian houses right there, and then there was this garden site which had the rice root lily. And Ken thinks it also had something that resembled a drainage canal. And one of my goals in this past summer's fieldwork was to explore the occurrence of rice root and document rice root sites in the middle and upper Stina and Gixan Coastal Territory. Although it turned out that it's very difficult to collect in late summer. As part of that research, I flew into a Gixan fishery research camp in the far northwestern corner of the upper Stina drainage, a place called Slam Beach Lake. I'm much indebted to the two technicians who helped me there with my fieldwork and to the Gixan Watershed Authority for giving me a free plane ride into the Upper Stina to get into this site. And we went into a small old abandoned village site with house pits near the site of a historic fish weir. And we found this rice root plant that we showed here. It's in fruit here, not in flower like the pretty one we showed earlier. But you can see the little rice root grains down in the bottom of the plant next to Bill Squire's finger. So we were able to collect quite a interior and northern site. And here's the meadow vegetation where it was growing. Those of you who are plant people, if any, might recognize yarrow flowers, the little white flowers here. So it looks like a pretty typical sort of low meadow site. A short distance away from that, across a tangle of willow and alder and across the several creek channels in Waders, there's another meadow. And Bill Squires, one of the two fisheries technicians working for the Gippsland Watershed Authority, said he'd seen lots of rice root in the area where he's standing in the springtime. We didn't find any remains of it still above ground at this time. But Bill knows the plant well because he's originally from the Nass and he's not a young guy, so he's picked that plant himself in his younger years. And that meadow site itself is quite odd because it has aspen trees growing in the middle of it. And you're otherwise in an area that's full of hemlock and quite a coniferous and cool and moist and leafy kind of place. In the middle, and it's got willow thickets around it, and then in the middle of this open area that feels like somebody's field, there's a clump of aspen tree. So it feels very much like that site has been converted by landscape burning in the past to its present vegetation. And the plants are there. And in case we're wondering about association with cultural sites, this is kind of small, but this is a map of a portion of the Chief Sikidimnak-Kudé's territory in the Upper Sandy's drainage. And the little black words are named Gippsland places in the Gippsland language. And I've added the rice root localities to it, and they're both associated with villages or camps. And there's a main trail to the Nass drainage that goes right along Sandbeach Creek and across the Divide into the Nass. Another point to make is that these Upper Skeena localities are very near an ancestral Gippsland village whose name is Gitandas, which means people of the rice root lily. And their oral histories say that Gippsland people originated from that village at some unknown period of time in the past, but suggests that the association of people with that plant is quite ancient. Attempts at chronology might put that dispersal more than 3,000 years ago. And of course, it's always tricky to mix Western and indigenous systems to try to figure out exactly when something that's attested in the oral history might have occurred. So to summarize, everywhere Ken and I have seen rice root, except for a few spots on the shore on the coast, it's been associated with places of human use and habitation. And people, even today, when asked, can tell the places that they've seen it, attesting to its persistent cultural importance despite decades of disuse in those places. Now I'd like to turn to my second plant, Pacific crabapple. Pacific crabapple also has a largely coastal distribution. These crabapple trees photographed in bloom in May of 1984 along Observatory Inlet at a NISCA site typify the coastal distribution and habitat of wild crabapples for me. And when I showed this slide at the ethnobiology meeting just a couple of weeks ago, Deanna Nice, a Tsimshian woman who lives on the Nass with her Niska husband, suddenly piped up, "That's my husband's place," underscoring the association of crabapple trees with camps and habitations even on the coast, which is the center of its geographic distribution. So here's a range map of Pacific crabapple, and you can see that in the northern part of its range, it hugs the coast quite closely. But it does extend inland a bit in the Skeena area. And then it's further inland down in the Fraser drainage. These are the localities that Ken and I know for Pacific crabapple in our region of interest. As with the rice root map, the sites with black dots are places where we've seen specific crab apple growing. The observatory inlet site is marked there for the top. And the sites with pink are places where we've been told crab apples grow by First Nations consultants. Ken was told by Cecil Paul, a Haisla chief, that on the Coesus River, the sweet variety of crab apple grows. And the Haisla have a really prized wild crab apples and have a very subtle knowledge of the shapes and tastes of different varieties of them on the coast, which is quite interesting, suggesting, again, a very long association of people with this plant. As with the red fruit lily, all the cultures in the area have names specific crab apple. And you might note that there's also a word on this chart for an owned crab apple patch in Tsimshian, Nakhmolk. Tsimshian is related to Gibson, so Molks and Milks are cognate, as is the Niskar word not listed on here. And the Wissotian word, Milks, is a loan word because they speak an unrelated language. The crab apple doesn't really grow in their range, so they know about it from their neighbors north of the coast. They borrowed the word for crab apples. In Ken's field work in Kalon Canyon, he encountered this grove of wild crab apple trees, which he calls the orchard, on the top of a ridge at a site called Robintown, a name for robins. And you can see in the inset photo the green fruits. They're quite small. They're sort of the size and shape of cherries there, and they grow in clusters. This tree has round fruits. There are differences in the shape of the crab apple fruits, depending on which one of it you have. And this site was an extremely interesting one. Aside from being associated with a well-described habitation site that's in many oral history, it also it's a very unusual vegetation. Besides this clump of crab apples, which would look more at home on the coast, you have subalpine fir and very scented black huckleberries, which would look more at home in a more interior site and higher up the mountain. And you have all these interesting persistent openings with a mixture of economically important species in this Kalon Canyon area. So it suggests that the people of Kitsum Kalon lived and managed the landscape in that area of the Kalon Valley for a long time.
Leslie, I'm sorry, I missed another question. Is there any accounting for the gap in the Alaskan coast? This, I think, was another comment from Maureen on a slide, three slides ago, where there was
I'd have to look carefully at what the environments are, and at this point in time, without thinking carefully about it, I don't have any explanation for that distribution.
Okay.
It might be that the environments are too severe, have more freezing. I'm not sure, without looking at the slides, whether Glacier Bay, for example, or where the Alaskan Glacier came down might be areas where it's absent. Perhaps there are areas with fewer islands and less maritime climate. Okay, well, Ken's fieldwork really got me thinking. When I went with him to the Robintown locality, I'm sitting there thinking, all right, now I've known the Gibson word for crab apples for 20 years. I did my dissertation on Gibson ethnobotany. I collected doctor specimens of everything I could find. I never could find a crab apple tree to collect a botanical specimen from rivers. So it's one of the reasons, in fact, that I applied for an ARF to go find where the crab apples. And son of a gun, I got back there this August, and I still couldn't find any crab apples. I even tried going to the place on the Telegraph Trail that's named Crab Apple Milk. There were no crab apples there that I could find, just willows in this otherwise open meadow area. So when I was talking to Sigidemna Fude, on Latai about asking for permission to go into her territory to collect specimens, I mentioned the crab apple, that was the other species I was looking for, and she said,
talked to Mary Dalen in Cedarville.
Mary Dalen in Cedarville. I used to live in Cedarville for 12 years. So I went down and talked to Mary Dalen, and I said, you know, she said, okay, who sent you? You know, I get her my gift jar of canned fruit, and we're talking, and Mary said, but Yvonne told me that you knew where there was a crabapple tree here. And she pointed behind there at this tree pictured in her yard. And I've probably driven by that tree hundreds of times. It's completely visible from the little loop in Cedarville on the old ferry road. I used to live at a house a few hundred meters from there. I always thought it was a domestic apple tree. I never thought a thing about it. And it turned out that tree has been in the yard of that house ever since Mary's grandfather allowed the missionary Reverend Tomlinson to build a mission village in that place, and her family's been looking after that tree for about 120 years. It's the only crab apple I've seen in the Upper Skeena, although I've now heard of a couple in people's yards in the village of Kitsikisla, one by the graveyard, and a few other sites along the Cedarville Back Road, which is a major travel trail, or down by the river in sites that people use, riverside sites. So it looks to me like, in fact, the range of, or the sites of crabapple in that part of the Skeena are beyond the natural range of the tree. And if they weren't deliberately planted, they may have been accidentally propagated in places where people were consuming crab apples and then carefully tended when they were noticed because they're a tree that people prize. And it's also, for example, part of a crest, and Gitxan crests are sort of heraldic owned properties of chiefs. But there are the grouse crest of real Gitmu grouse, which shows the grouse with a clump of wild crab apple in it. So it's high cultural importance. And here are the crab apples from this tree, and they're an oblong shape, and they were not very sweet when picked. Mary and her son were enthusiastic upon my interest in their tree and insisted on helping me pick the crab apples, which I then took and cooked with sugar and gave to some people. They were quite tasty. Now I'd like to turn to berries and berry patch management. And here we shift a bit. We're not looking at plants which are incredibly localized in their occurrence here. But on the other hand, the cultural importance of black huckleberries is incredible. And it's the most important plant food for Gitxan and Wet'suwet'en people. They're large, juicy, and sweet, and on good sites, they yield lots of berries. So this was the most important carbohydrate food of peoples in the Skeena. But it's a cereal species, which means that it only thrives on open sites and will be shaded out if tall shrubs and young forest trees are the topic. It doesn't actually die for a long time, but it becomes short and spindly and doesn't produce any fruit. Given how important it was, it couldn't really afford to let that happen. People talk a lot about huckleberry sites, and I've previously written a couple of papers about traditional management of huckleberries. The berries are linked to house group territories for Gitxan and Wet'suwet'en people, and houses are their sort of social subdivisions within villages, the very fundamental kin-based structures that still structure their societies. And they're important in the potlatch. So it's part of demonstrating the linkage of social groups to land. People distribute berries to honor guests at potlatch ceremonies. And that's what Leonard George Smuggler-Gim is doing here. As a guest chief, he's been given a bunch of
Huckleberry, the whole basin full, to distribute to other house members. So this is the range of black huckleberry in our region. As you see, it's in the interior, not on the coast. I was intrigued to notice there's actually a little blip by Lesser Slave Lake in Alberta, which I didn't know it occurred outside of the mountains at all, but there it is. And it lives in fire-prone coniferous forests, and it grows up to timberline, especially in southern portions of its range. And down in Oregon and Washington and in many other places, there's evidence of Aboriginal management. For Gixan, black huckleberry is the berry, and their name, Simma'i, means real or true berry. Both Gixan and Wet'suwet'en formerly and still trade black huckleberries with coastal nations in exchange for coastal specialties like seaweed, ulukum, grease, or herring eggs. And the upper Tsimshian of the terrace area are reported by Jim McDonald, an anthropologist who's worked with him extensively, to use black huckleberry, but he doesn't provide the Tsimshian name, so I can't put it on this chart. And the Scott name that I've recorded here is taken from Stephen McNeary's thesis written in the 70s, although I think actually he may have mixed up the name with that for the high-bush blueberry. Mizan is the Gixan name for high-bush blueberry, and the language is quite closely related, but maybe not. There is a Haisla name. I don't know whether they get it up in the mountains or by trade, and there's no name reported for Haida. Doesn't grow out on the coast. Black huckleberries were formerly harvested in huge quantities on productive berry patches. Whole villages or large kin groups would camp at special berry camps in the mountains near productive patches, and when sufficient berries had been picked, they were cooked in large cedar bentwood boxes, and we're talking maybe a meter-sized box, fill that up with berries and add hot rocks and put the cedar bark mat over the top, and that's how they were cooked in the past. So when the jam was thick, it was ladled onto leaf-lined berry racks to be dried into giant fruit levers, which were then carried down the mountains rolled up. You can see the racks at the top, and in the middle, you can see the berries, cooked berries that are laid on leaves to keep them from dripping through. And the drawing on the right shows the rolled up giant fruit leather. So those giant fruit leathers were the way they were aboriginally stored for winter. You stick them on the stick up between your rafters to keep the mice and critters from enjoying them, and then you reconstitute them or just chew on them dry when the time comes. And also in that rolled up form, they could be carried on the back to the coast for trade. More recently, people have walked up the mountains and brought the berries down or traveled by wagon or truck to do that. And they jar them and give away the jars at potlatch or freeze them. Here's a couple of archival photos that show how berries were carried down the mountain in bentwood boxes and how they were dried on wraps over a small smoky fire to keep off flies and yellow jackets. And as I've kind of indicated, berries are part of the connection of house groups with territories. Berry patches were important owned properties, often named. Trails were constructed to get to them, because it was really important to have productive berry patches, both to feed your group and to be able to distribute goods and potlatches to others in the community.
Yeah. Would the bears and other animals like these berries too? Or
oh, yeah.
So were there defenses built up? I mean, were there any...
Let's see, relations with bears. Well, there are a lot of oral histories about bears and the necessity to respect them. We could go, I shouldn't digress here, but there's a Tsimshian story about the princess who stepped in the bear shit while she was picking berries and got really annoyed about it and basically cursed the bear and dropping her berries and various things happen, and next thing you know, this handsome young man carries her off. It turns out to be a bear. She is, in fact, married to a bear, and it goes on from there. Respect is highly necessary. You know, as with many indigenous animals in the landscape are attention, and there's a social relationship with them. Which also can mean that you can talk to the bears and explain what you're doing there and talk about sharing. And people don't usually walk out on the berry patch singly, so there's likely to be a number of people and possibly dogs and whatever traveling on the berry patch together, and you're probably not maintaining silence. So any bear that's there knows that you are in the area, and probably some accommodation is going to occur. This map shows the distribution of known berry patches that have been described to us. I'm sure there were others, but these are ones that people described to me and to Scott Tressler in the course of our research. And they're located approximately with respect to the rivers and to the contemporary village sites. And I haven't tried to show fish camps or hunting camps or trails or the territory, because the map would be very difficult to interpret if all of that information was laid on there. But just to give you a sense of the berry patches, and most of them are sort of up on the mountain, but not all of them. Some of them are lower elevation. And they were managed. The late Martha Brown, said pretty well they burn the area every 2 years because this is their livelihood, where they pick their berry crop. And both my former student Scott Tressler and I have recorded extensive information about details of berry patch burning. And probably rotational burning was done in large berry patch areas so that part of the site would remain productive while other parts were being removed by burning, sort of like three field fallow system in European agriculture. You know, you burn the berry patch, you can't pick that exact spot for 2 or 4 years. They have underground rhizomes, and they sprout vigorously when the top is removed. They're quite fire adapted, and in fact, they are strongly renewed by that process. When you get big and heavy fruit in a berry patch area that's been burned, if you don't burn it, it's overtopped by trees and taller shrub species, and eventually any remnant berry plants have very low cover and very small size. Part of Scott's research actually involved going to some of those red dots on the map. He has a background in forestry research, and so he found the places, walked around on them, and as part of his master's thesis, characterized those sites ecologically and described the condition of any berry plants they encountered. So at low elevation, you might get a deciduous woodland with a bunch of other species in there, but a little or no huckleberry. At mid-slope sites, he has one where he's got berry rack leaned up against a tree, and you're in the middle of a hemlock forest that's 80 years old. There's no berries in there at all. You know, a few tiny little plants struggling in the shade. And at high elevation, it stays open for longer, but you get shade-tolerant other shrubs overtopping the black huckleberry, and you get the nigran, the high bush blueberry, which has a waterier, less sweet fruit that the Ixchel don't prefer, and other things like false huckleberry that have no fruit.
Another question from Maureen, and she wants to know how large were some of these patches.
I don't know in hectares. I could look at Scott's thesis, but I don't know. But not tiny. You know, that's probably not really an answer. But there you go. More than a hectare. Big spots, 20 hectares, 50 hectares maybe more.
I think that gives her more than she had before.
There you go. Bagpatch breeding was suppressed by the British Columbia Forest Service in the 1920s and 30s, as they did not understand the ecology of the berry species, nor the fact that Indian burning wasn't carelessness and just wanton destruction of forests, but actually a management strategy, and they were focused on the idea of wasting trees. This was, of course, the heyday of Smokey the Bear, and for people whose notion of cultivation is pastures and fields, they considered the forest to be something that was supposed to be developed for wood resources. So in the absence of management, this is what you get, no berry patches. Here, Scott Flew's asked huckleberry plants under low light conditions. At the left, tiny little plant, you can see by the size of the dried leaves next to them. And at high light intensities, where they are shrubs about 40 to 90 centimeters tall and have damp cover and may be quite productive. It can be just black with berries. So I mentioned before, I alluded to the fact that they are named, berry patches are named owned properties and then infrastructure was constructed. And it's probably hard to see, but the village of Gitwangah is indicated on the topo map there. And you can see some lineation of trails with dotted lines here. And those were trails that were described to me and drawn on maps by people who were familiar with topographic maps. And you can see that two of these berry patches I know the names of. One means the place with the real berry on it, on Tim Nye, and the other means bluegrass's berry on it. On Kimaelichis. So, and elders talked to me about traveling to the two named sites and what it was like to put berries there. And that was probably in the 50s, or maybe not that late, after automobiles and canners. So olives would go up there with relatives and they'd pass the berries back down the mountain and they would jar them in the village of Gitwangah. When she was a young woman, when she's deceased now for about a while, I'm trying to remember, I can't think how long, 10 or 15 years. But when she was a young woman, a little girl, she's the one who described to me how the berries were cooked on the berry patch. And then her grandmother was Hanamuk. She talked about how the whole village of Andamal walked up the mountain and what it was like being on the berry camp. When she was a mother, an adult married woman, then she went up the mountain on foot and picked her berries and canned them. She also mentioned that those berry patches are overgrown, that they're big trees now. This photograph is just another view of sort of how the berry patch is integrated into the landscape. So this spot here, Winley Miss, is a berry patch name. It's named for this red shale feature here. It's on a Wolf Clan territory of Timogit Dinumget, Art Matthews. This is the territory boundary down this creek. The access trail comes from a fish camp down here by the river. And this area at the top is an alpine resource area for groundhogs, which they ate. And on the backside of that knoll for mountain goats. So you can sort of see that the harvesting of berries and the management of those patches is integrated into a bunch of other things that are going on the same landscape. Okay, I'm going to jump now to a picture here on black huckleberry. Back to the Robintown site. When I went with Kim and we picked the crab apples, he had not noticed the stunted black huckleberry. As we were walking to this crab apple orchard, not far from it, maybe 100 meters, I said, oh, look at that, there's black huckleberry here. And it was, about 12 centimeters tall, a spindly little plant with no fruit on it. But what was it doing there? This is coastal western hemlock forest, and it's low elevation. So that was there, and there was also a Sabalfi through there, which was kind of puzzling, suggesting some unusual vegetation and a real conjunction of coastal and interior species on the site of long human habitation. I'm going to move now to our last species, beach hazelnut. It's a tall nut-bearing shrub, very abundant in the middle Skeena and parts of the Nass River. It's a signature shrub of the so-called Hazelton variant, and one guess as to why that Hazelton is called Hazelton in English. Of the interior cedar hemlock zone, which is a lower elevation forest type with persistent aspen, birch, prickly rose, wild cherries, and hazel. It's kind of more like some of the vegetation around here, because there's a lot of birch. So in a place where most of the landscape is heavily forested with coniferous forest, down in the valley bottom, you have these things that the ecologists used to think should be succeeding to hemlock and spruce and balsam and so on, and they remain in deciduous cover. Forest ecologists now believe that the open deciduous growth in these valley bottoms has been promoted by long First Nations occupation of this landscape and by landscape burning. Having lived in the center of this, I didn't realize what a restrictive distribution hazel actually has in British Columbia. This shrub was photographed along the fence of my garden. I had lots of hazel in my yard. So here's the range of it. It follows very closely in the interior to the hemlock zone, and it occurs only in the valley bottoms, not up on the slopes. But of course, in the valley bottoms, in the cedar hemlock zone, and around Hazelton is precisely where the villages are. Gixan, Miskan, and Wet'suwet'en named this shrub, but names are not recorded for other languages of the region, as the plant doesn't occur on the coast. And elders did describe to me collecting hazel when they were children around Hazelton, particularly by stealing it from squirrel caches. The jays and the squirrels are very quick to harvest it. They have to be quite on the ball if you want to get any of it. So hazel occurs throughout the Skeena and its tributaries around Hazelton. And elders like Simogut Lugoff, Pete Mulbeau, mentioned that when he was a young boy in the early 20th century, there weren't any trees at all around the village of Tikadok, down on the, just near Hazelton on the, probably on the Skeena, sorry, so the Skeena or the Kispios, which river is it on? Anyway, I think it's on the Skeena. It was all burnt and there were hazels everywhere. But now it's got a lot of birch and trees on the top. But it also occurs in this Kalem Canyon area. Ken ran into clumps of hazel, which looked unusual to him. He lives in Terrace, and he's also done work as a forestry technician. Hazel is really uncommon around there. And in fact, it's off of its range map, if you look at the range map I showed earlier. The clumps of hazel are in Kitsilis Canyon, which is an area of about 4,000 years of human occupation, attested by archaeological sites, and they're in Kalem Canyon. And contemporary Tsimshian, recorded by anthropologist Jim McDonald, talked about how their relatives transplanted hazel from Kitsilis Canyon to their present reserve village site in Kitsilis Canyon. So the movement of hazel as a desirable, useful shrub is still occurring today. So to kind of sum up here, in considering the distribution and cultural associations of these various plants, rice root lily looks strongly as if it were transported from the coast along transportation corridors and established in camp, garden, and village areas, which may have been kept open by human activity. And Pacific crabapple occurs apparently east of its natural range, and it looks very strong as if this is due to human activity and management. I was really struck by the fact that I had been looking for crabapple all these years in the bush, and I should have been looking in the village.
Marie has another question.
Yeah.
Is there a way to date the age of plant species? I guess by the recorded first appearance, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what is meant there. You could age the tree through tree ring dating.
I think she may be looking for the evolution or, you know, the appearance of the plant.
In a region, you could probably find, or you might be able to find pollen or fossil evidence in sites, in bog sites or pollen cores. I don't at the moment remember whether there was any crab apple at the, Chiffonbrough Fort site, which is a national park, which historic park which had macrofossil plant remains down there. So I don't know off the top of my head how old that species is. We'll talk a little more about crabapple and its association with people in a sec here. I just wanted to finish with my fourth species. So black huckleberry, that is managed by burning throughout its range, and its western limits in the senior drainage looks to me to be the result of human activity again because of where it's found. And the occurrence of bee hazelnut in the Skeena Nass regions is probably due to long-term human influence on the vegetation, and that its western limits, it appears to have been deliberately planted, as Jim McDonald's evidence suggests. So, is it cultivated? There's evidence that suggests rice root lily, a wild crab apple, black huckleberry, and bee hazelnut were deliberately maintained by human activity, and that they may have been propagated. For example, Jim McDonald reports that Alex Bolton told him there was a rice root garden further down the Skeena estuary, the mouth of the Oxbow, where many people who presently live in Kipling Hale and Cornell live. And that fits in with evidence that Doug Dewar and Nancy Turner have recorded from further south in British Columbia, where you have these tidal estuary root gardens, which were weeded and rocks and debris were removed from them, and they might have been had rocks put along their shoreward side to prevent erosion, and they were intensively harvested for root crops by coastal people. Yeah, Jane?
I have a question about
My question is about the definition you're using of management. Would it be, as you've got there on the board, maintained by human activity and propagated by humans as sort of the basic definition of what being managed is? Because I keep thinking of sort of more modern conceptions of management as being something sort of centralized and I'm probably overlaying it with conceptions that you're not using. So you probably mean something quite specific by managed. So I'm just wondering if you're sure.
So management, when I say a plant is managed by a human group, I mean that people that people engage in activities which encourage its abundance and productivity. So this could mean not cutting it down when you clear an area. This could mean weeding or burning to suppress competing vegetation so that the plant that you want flourishes. This could mean deliberately planting it in places where it didn't grow and then encouraging the plant to grow and bear fruit. So that's what I'm meaning by plant management as opposed to human resources management or something like that. Okay, there you go. Sorry, sometimes I have trouble thinking about who will my audience be and what diverse backgrounds and terminologies that will be bringing to the listening experience. Okay, so...
Do you have a thought of managing?
I'd be the thought of managing plants, you know, I'd be unlucky if they survive.
There you go. Some of us are gardeners and some of us... My mother swore she had a brown thumb. If she touched a plant, it died. Okay, let's see, where are we here? Okay. So the question of cultivation is interesting. Where are we here? I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to say. Ken felt that evidence for cultivation of both rice fruit and wild crab apple was quite strong at Kitsilis and Salem Canyon. And ethnographic evidence reported by Jim McDonald tends to support this. I mentioned the rice fruit meadow down at the Uxtal and the transplantation of hazel. While we were speaking at the ethnobiology meeting about the question of whether the garden site was really gardened, in Canyon, Deanna Knight spoke in excitedly to say that she remembered gardening with her grandmother at Kitsilis, and that the site in Salem Canyon also belonged to her family. So she was great to have her in the audience. I had not met her before, and it was really, really interesting. And Haifa owned and tend individual crabapple trees. Interesting. They were highly valued enough that people would claim ownership of specific trees. And my friend Lloyd mentioned to me that people would hang salmon in the branches to feed the tree, which is an interesting concept. Of course, Western science might understand that it's a pretty good shot of nitrogen fertilizer and phosphorus as well, which is good for fruiting. And you might also get some bare pruning if the fruiters were appreciating the offering on the tree, which could encourage new sprouts and branching and make the bring the height of the tree down closer to where people could pick it without a ladder. I thought that was interesting.
Lay the salmon near the roots?
Interestingly, no. Lloyd told me that they put it in the branches. And of course, breeding to enhance various species occurs widely in British Columbia and has even been reported, at least in limited area, by Nancy Turner for the Haida and the Haifa right out on the coast. Not for the same species. They weren't managing for black huckleberry out there, but renewing various species to burning. Whether hazels were directly managed for is hard to say at this point, but it's possible that in the past they might have managed small patches as well as encouraging them directly or indirectly through practices of landscape burning. Another question that was interesting, the question whether you can tell where people were by the vegetation. And my ex, chief scientist at the Gitan Laboratory, Alan Gottesfeld, told me about going up to Skeena to look for rice root. He'd sort of forgotten that its center of distribution is actually on the coast because he's been working upriver for a long time. And he said whenever he sees certain meadow formations where the rice root really occurs, he assumes it's an anthropogenic meadow. So it seems to be vegetation type where the plant occurs that marked to me as an occupation. Ethnoarchaeologist Sheila Greer, who works primarily in the Yukon with the Champagne Asiac First Nation, brought up the possibility that the persistence of some of these important plants, like rice root lily in inland situations, might enable mapping of former use sites in the Alsac Tatsushimi basin, you know, which people have been excluded from there because it's part of Kewaunee National Park for quite a while, and they've just recently been recovering their rights and their co-management rights in that area. Another feature that makes actual archaeology hard to do there is that there are glacial outburst floods which wipe out everything that might be lying around on the ground, but the plants are there. So Sheila was wondering if you could maybe map, help corroborate oral histories by looking at what plants are there. And finally, both Ken Downs, who's a kayaker, and my colleague Daniel Popsky from the archaeology department at Simon Fraser, who's also a kayaker, say, all the old camp and midden sites have crab apples. When you're traveling along the coast the way that the indigenous people did in the past, the places that are good camp spots, there are the crab apples. And that was also corroborated by Madonna Law for the Tlingit area in southeast Alaska, where crab apples are really strongly associated with fishing sites. So it makes you actually wonder whether crab apples are almost domesticated. Yeah, I don't know enough about the southern end of their range, so I don't really know how close the association of crab apples with human habitation sites is in the south. I'm going to let Jim McDonald have the last word. As I was preparing this talk, I came across this quote from Jim, which underscores the observations of my colleagues. Fruit trees were frequently tended, and people now consider the presence of hazelnut trees and crabapple trees a sure sign of an old residential community or campsite. I was often told the same, Jim, that wherever the old people camped, there are crabapples. The old people planted nut saplings from Kitsilas Canyon around their Kitsilas Kalam town site. I hadn't caught that quote of Jim's when I was looking at his paper before, and it really just stood out after I'd been writing the text of this talk. So, in closing, I'd like to acknowledge some of the many people who have helped me in this research and some of the funders. And I've listed them there because there's a lot of people. And Ken, when we gave our talk at the ethnobiology meeting, also wanted to acknowledge the people of Kitsilas and Kitsilas Kalam, and Ki Iljus, Barbara Wilson from Haida Gwaii, and Cecil Paul from Kitimat. And I'd like to add Deanna Knight to that list of people for her spontaneous comments at the ethnobiology meeting, which was very useful. Athabasca University provided the most recent funding for myself and for Ken to work on this project, which is not completed. And a number of other funders funded earlier research where I gained some of the insights that are presented here. Thanks for listening.
I have a question, it's Kathy. Is there any evidence in oral history for planting the berries? I mean, it's true that the berries are a huge source of food for bears, and I know that the bears distribute the berries, you know, with their scat, because I've been in the patches here. And you had that story about the princess and the bear. So I'm just wondering, you know, did they talk anything at all about planting the berries? Besides, I mean, they talk about burning for management, but is there any evidence of management flooding?
I think they actually planted, but I could be wrong. The plant is quite widespread.
Mm.
And so between bears and berries and whatever, you know, it grows from the Oregon Cascades, you know, up to the Yukon border. And it can be renewed by wildfire and more recently by forestry activities, provided you don't herbicide the time after you cut your tree. So I think it's more that what they did was perhaps begin with places where the plant grew, observe its response to intentional or unintentional burns, and then adopt a management system. In contrast to the other plants, which, well, at least to the rice root lily and the crabapple, which may have actually been where individual plants may have been planted, and to the hazel, which may be transplanted. Are there any other questions here or out in cyberspace?
There's Jeff had to go, but he enjoyed it. He had trouble hearing, but
I just had a few things actually that's so interesting. Now, did the First Nations people have any notion of fertilizer? I know you mentioned the salmon was up in the tree, but I wonder, is that something that more, you know, Western agriculturists think of?
I don't know whether people would have understood fertilizing in that sense.
Yeah.
It becomes important where you have permanent fields,
mm-hmm.
the fertility of the site declines because you're continually removing mm-hmm. nutrients in the form of your harvest.
Yeah.
You have to put them back in. Mm-hmm. The burning itself provides fertilizer in terms of mineral nutrients,
mm-hmm.
as well as removing the thick organic layer, which may impede plant sprouting.
Yeah, and I was just wondering too, how they cooked the rice root. What did they do with that?
Wash
it
and pit cook it.
Yeah.
In the past, it doesn't take really long cooking. It's rather bitter, especially if you have upriver plants, and so they tended to use a sweetener with it,
mm-hmm.
Particularly hemlock cambium. Hemlock is not poison hemlock. Hemlock is a hemlock tree.
Yeah.
And if you take the edible inner bark in the springtime and process it by cooking and drying, it's quite sweet and has a lot of sugars in it. So originally they did it that way. More recently you might cook it with Roger's Golden Syrup.
Mm-hmm. That's what interesting is that cultural exchange. Now, did it go the other way? I mean, did later immigrants ever try using rice root or in any of theirs? No.
No, but certainly everybody picked huckleberries.
And the crab apples, I presume. Did they cook crab apples too or dry them?
They would have cooked them.
Mm-hmm.
They probably, I'm just trying to think, would they have been cooked and preserved in Greece? Probably. They didn't can it aboriginally. So your choices are the sort of fruit leather approach, which mm-hmm. you do with the black huckleberries, or some other things like cranberries and crab apples. I'm trying to think whether they were cooked first, and I can't remember, but I might suspect. Mm-hmm. They either would have been cooked first or afterwards, I think, and mm-hmm. they would have been put in a big box with a layer of grease over the top to seal mm-hmm. it,
yeah.
stored in a cool place. A lot of those fruits are eaten with grease sources, like the olefin grease.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think of it like putting whipped cream on your berries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different cultural taste, because it doesn't taste like whipped cream. I just do not want fish grease on their berries unless they're indigenous. Those few of you always would have been a slightly more northerly approach to putting grease on your berries. But we use cow grease. We need to even find out our whipped cream on our berries. So, any other questions, or shall I go find some fruit?
Yes, why don't we all finish off the rest of the fruit? We've got some comments. Maureen asks, and sorry for this because you don't want to know why, where does your research go from here? And then there was a comment about the rebirth spirituality and burning is very key to the indigenous worldviews.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in relation to the previous management comment, fish and tree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if all this makes sense, but maybe you could comment on it. And thanks, Maureen. Or Maureen, she's got her hand raised as well. Maybe she has a question. I'll turn
it over. Okay, let's find out what.
Sorry, I haven't really used this microphone, so I don't know how it sounds on your end. I was just, the comments about the rebirth and the was in relation to the question from the woman from the floor asking about as cultivation methods. And I was just thinking that given the holistic worldview of the Tsimshian and how reincarnation is very, very important, that maybe the cyclical nature of plant management was incorporated into that. Did you hear any of that?
Okay, we got it.
Okay. Yes, I heard you talk about the cyclical nature of plant management and connections to reincarnation. Certainly it is a huge sense, I think, as I understand it, of that sort of rebirth and rejuvenation. And I don't see any reason why the cycle of the year and the cycle of harvest and the cycle of management shouldn't also be related to the cycle of life. In terms of where does the research go from here, Ken and I still need to do some more work. And at the ethnobiology meeting, people suggested an interesting angle, which is to find out whether there's genetic evidence that rice root lily upriver comes from coastal populations, which we may try to do. And we also intend to continue to document more localities and record more information from those who want to share information about particular sites and history of harvesting. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay, I'll try the microphone again. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Try the microphone again and what?
Thank you, Maureen. And thanks. You're the only one out there, so thanks for attending. Are there any other questions in the room? Well, if not, I want to thank Leslie for a really interesting talk. One of the things I was left with was the breadth of knowledge one has to have, not only in terms of botany and geography and anthropology. I mean, you're sort of really out there on your own, and it was impressive to hear all what you know, not just in terms of the anthropology behind it. So I want to thank you for presenting at the Arts and Science Speakers Series. I also want to remind those online or in the room that Jay Smith will be speaking May 18th on something. And that we want to thank the research office for providing the treats for this meeting. And that, again, the recording will be accessible. So if you know people who didn't weren't able to attend, you can direct them to the Arts and Science website. Thanks again. Happy. All right, well, I guess that's it. And thanks, everyone.
Thanks to all of us. We're all here. I'm going to go eat.